Magic.me is the world's greatest school for magic, meditation, and mysticism. You can learn everything there, from chaos magic to hermeticism, to meditation, to how to supercharge your finances and take absolute control of your destiny. In short, you get all of the tools you need to turn chaos into beautiful, scintillating order and master your life. It's incredible. You've probably heard me talk about it on the show quite a lot, but check it out. It's growing fast. And I just want to say, if you're confused about where to start, because I have so many courses there, the Adept Initiative is the place to go. The Adept Initiative is the flagship course on Magic.me, and it contains everything you need to know to master the most profound ancient techniques of changing your consciousness and the most modern and cutting-edge tools and systems for absolutely turning your life into a masterpiece. You are really going to dig it. Go check it out, and I will see you in class. It's magic.me, magick.me.
Thank you very much for being on the show. Please tell us a bit about your book and your own work and who you are.
Jackie Cole and my husband Harvey Rice, and we have written a book called The Flight of the Bun Monks. It's a true story. It's a story about my meditation teacher's escape from Tibet in 1959. I'm a retired veterinarian and a student of Bun for over 20 years. Harvey, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm a retired journalist. I retired from the Houston Chronicle, where I worked for 18 years. And before that, I worked for several other newspapers and United Press International when it was an actual worldwide wire service. It has fallen on hard times since then. And that's all probably all you need to know about me.
Well, let me ask you, both of you, you know, to come from a background of being a veterinarian and a journalist for the Houston Chronicle, that's amazing. What made you decide to change tracks into the wide world of Tibetan shamanism? I mean, was this kind of just slowly crept up, or did it hit you all at once?
Well, I sort of got called through a dream to study something in the Tibetan Buddhism realm. And Bun found me, and I just stuck with it. So that's been 20 years. I've been studying the traditions of Bun and the tools that they use to help you live a better life. And so Harvey, being the journalist and in being with the teachers and so forth, I found out just little snippets here and there what they went through in trying to escape from Tibet. We knew some about the Tibetan diaspora through the Buddhism and the Dalai Lama's escape and the reestablishment of the Tibetan government in exile. But I began to hear little snippets about the Bumpos who were able to escape, and the fact that they were getting older and there were only a few of the masters that had lived in Tibet prior that were still alive. So I talked to Harvey about us doing a book about it, or a story about it, writing it up, because it was critical that we get the story before they passed on. Not necessarily us, but that the story get written down before they passed on. So we agreed to take it on and went and asked for permission, blessings, which they very graciously gave us, and it's been a 10-year journey to write this book.
It's incredible. So let's do some groundwork and talk about Bun, or I think that's how it's pronounced. I always feel like I get anything with an umlaut, I fear. But what is it, and how does it relate to, you know, is my understanding it is the prior to Tibetan indigenous shamanism. But what is it, and how does it relate to Tibetan Buddhism, and why are people still practicing it today now that Vajrayana has become a thing?
And Bun was the original to religion in Tibet prior to Buddhism coming in the 7th century. And so it has a very ancient lineage of tradition there in Tibet. And in the 7th century, one was the king decided that to make Buddhism the rule of the religion of the crown and the religion of the country and banned Bun. And so Bunpo's had to either convert or leave or quit practicing. And so along with that came all of the negative stories that were made up about Bun being black magic and not your kind of magic, but black everything, practices, and so on and so forth. And so it fell by the wayside. It was able to re-flourish in the 11th century to come back and begin to be practiced again. At the time of the invasion of China in the 50s, there was fewer than a third of the population, but still a substantial number of people who practiced Bun as their tradition. In Tibet, the religion and the culture is so intertwined that there is no separation. And where Bun is practiced, it's in each of the different schools of Buddhism, it's in villages and whole counties and so forth. So if you know where someone is from, you essentially know what religion they practiced or what their spiritual tradition was. And so it's practiced a lot in the eastern part of Tibet on the Kham and Ando regions. And then again in Nepal, in the Dolpo region, which is essentially ethnically Tibetan. Now, how does it differ from Buddhism? Well, if you ask the Bunpos would say that Buddhism borrowed everything it knew from Bun and acclimatized it there back when it came in from India and merged it with Bun, which was the Tibetan culture, essentially, at the time. If you ask the Buddhists, they'll say that Bun borrowed everything from Buddhism in the 11th century when it began to be practiced again. So it depends on who you talk to. If you look at the iconography and the philosophy of it, they're pretty close. You wouldn't be able to, if you looked at a Tanka, unless you actually knew, which is a drawing or a painting of some of the iconography, you're not going to be able to tell unless you actually know or have studied it. But the gist of the Bun is similar to Buddhism in that it's a religion based on compassion and kindness and gives different kinds of tools for different situations, whether you need to try to influence the weather or your health or what's going to happen. And then also at the highest level, a curriculum for training your mind so that you can find your own true nature. Then if you can live in that own true nature, that's considered enlightenment.
That sounds basically comparable to the Western magical path as well, in as much as you have a basic ethical stance, you have some practices for making your life go a little bit better, and then you have the kind of the quest for the true self.
Yes.
However, so Bun does not. So my understanding of where Bun is, that Bun is the original indigenous shamanism of Tibet, similar to forms that are in Nepal, and that what Vajrayana was Padmasambhava brought the Indian metaphysics from India, from Naropa, and then grafted that on with the Bun shamanism. So my understanding up to this point has essentially been that you get this like extremely advanced Hindu metaphysics Hindu metaphysics based on emptiness and impermanence. And on the other hand, you get all this shamanic gear from Bun. So essentially you have the sorcery with an underpinning of emptiness and impermanence. That's Vajrayana. Now that to me seems like the best of all worlds, because you basically get to do magic and get your get out of jail free card as well, since you can fall back on emptiness. But Bun does not have a sense of metaphysics of emptiness. Am I correct? Like, what is the overall metaphysics of Bun?
It is interdependence. So it's emptiness, but it's not nihilism. So
that's Buddhism. Emptiness and independence is.
Well, that's what I said. You know, the Buddhist, depending on who you talk to, the Buddhist took it for, because Bunpo had, the Bun had Dzogchen and has had Dzogchen all along. It was not particularly widespread in that it was taught from one person to the next person to the next person orally, but it has been a part of the tradition all along. So Bun was not just the traditional rituals that were in Tibet that were separate from the metaphysical that came from India. There was metaphysical prior to that.
So that's kind of what I'm asking. What was the prior metaphysics? So it sounds like it actually Bun actually has adopted Buddhist metaphysics.
Or Buddhism adopted Bun's metaphysics.
Well, being
or they merged, or they merged.
Merged, definitely. I mean, yeah, certainly that, since it was from India. But what was the metaphysic prior to? But that also, that's interesting, because if they merged, then that essentially makes Bun a fifth school of Buddhism rather than its own shamanic thing.
Yes. And go ahead, Harvey.
I was going to say there are some historians that believe, one of them is one of the characters in our book, David Snellgrove, who has studied Tibetan religions extensively. It was his idea that they were the same. However, Bunpo's and the Bun officials would not agree with that at all, and they reject Snellgrove's assessment.
Wow. Basically, what I'm trying to get down to the kernel of the difference here, and it sounds like they're more similar, even on metaphysical points, which I didn't know. I'm trying to get down to the kernel of what makes Bunpa separate, and is it a different Buddha.
Okay. Tompa Shinrab is the founding Buddha of Bun, and whereas Shakyamuni or the Pabbasambhava brought is the Buddha from Indian Buddha that came into, that was then imported into Tibet in the 7th century. Came from India.
And the Bunpo's claim that Buddha, that is the Buddhist Buddha, actually got his philosophy from Bunpo's.
From Tompa Shinrab. He was a reincarnation of Tompa Shinrab.
Right. So of course the Buddhists do not agree with that at all, but that's what Bunpo say.
Being that the Buddha was enlightened in Northeast India in 500 BC, right, and then it went to across with the Upper Ashoka, that seems somewhat unlikely, but it makes sense as something. It makes sense as things that people would say in like Tibetan local politics, definitely.
Yeah.
So I'm curious also, you mentioned the bad, what do you call it, kind of reputation that Bun has had, and that it's from actually a long time ago. I had a prior question to ask you that, but I was going to ask you about, I feel like it has a bad reputation currently. And some of that I think is probably Blavatsky and Secret Doctrine starts going off about black hat yogis or something like that. But what is your sense of what the reputation Bun has now? And why do you, and if there has been a negative reputation, why do you think that is?
Well, I think there was a negative reputation stemming from the 7th century that just came all the way up through, in that they had to demonize it in order to make it okay to ban it. So they had to demonize it. And also there's a great misunderstanding as to what the practices are and the tradition and what the underlying things about it are. So there was ideas that there was blood sacrifices and various assorted things. But now the Bun is more, as more and more people are beginning to understand Bun and what it is, and whether it's an offshoot of Tibetan Buddhism or whether it's from its own source, the tenets of Bun now are peaceful and are helpful to people who want to try to practice it. But it is recognized by the 14th Dalai Lama, recognized it in 1978 as one of the basic religions of Tibet. The 5th Dalai Lama recognized it, but then it fell into disfavor again. But the 14th Dalai Lama has recognized it, and there is a Bunpo representative on Council of the Government in Exile.
What about
At the Potala, which is the summer residence of the Dalai Lama, it's an immense structure with 1,000 rooms. There is a plaque there that says that Bonn is recognized.
That came from the fifth Dalai Lama?
Yes. And so there's been... It's like you look at the relationship between Catholics and Protestants. I mean, they used to go to war over religion and they condemned the others as terrible. Well, there was a similar, among some factions of the Buddhist, there was a similar attitude, sort of, you might say radical Buddhists. They vilified the Bonpos and persecuted them. And
just as an aside, when you say talk about this, is sorry, I apologize, apologies in advance, but when you talk about radical Buddhists persecuting the Bonpo, I just imagine like a fleet of Buddhists on skateboards flying.
That's a great, I love, yeah, I will never get that out of my mind now. That's such a gift to me. Thank you.
Quite frightening to hear like 18 skateboards rolling towards you all at once with chanting.
But in any case, it wasn't true that all Buddhists felt that way about Bonpos, because there's a lot of, in our book, we talk about the two of the characters who are Bonpo monks. They go for they get their Geshe degree, which is, it's like a doctorate, but then they go to Lhasa, to the largest monastery in the Gelupa Buddhist tradition, which is the Dalai Lama's tradition, and they begin sort of advanced studies there. So they were accepted there into a Buddhist institution, and the Buddhists knew they were Bonpos, and they only had to answer one question. They asked them, do you believe in the founder of the Gelupa sect? And Bonpos do. They like Buddhist, they said, of course we do. And so they were allowed to enter the university. But so when Western scholars began studying Tibet, what they knew about Bonn was through Buddhist writings. And most of the Buddhist writings about Bonn had been sort of like a Catholic in the Middle Ages writing about Protestants. And so they said, oh, they're terrible people. They're, you know, they don't know anything and they're eating children, or, you know, there's all kinds of trouble. And this term black hat evolved from that, which they never wore black hats. So that's a totally
invented term. Is that like a theosophical delusion?
Yeah, but
fiction.
The black hat is theosophical, but there are sects that wear black hats, and so it's right. Just but does for the Bonpos, it's more
wear a black hat?
I'm not sure which does, but I do know there is some, but we don't, it's not really, it doesn't mean, it's more of a yeah, what you said.
But you know, the like the red hats and the yellow hats, they actually did wear red hats and yellow hats for ceremonies. But for instance, the Bonpos, during some of their ceremonies, they wear yellow hats and or red hats as well. But I mean, this, I think that was simply a term in an attempt to disparage them. That's my.
I'm curious why would Blavatsky have motivation to disparage this tiny, you know, group?
I have not read him, so I can't address that. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
to say.
I don't know who I
will.
She was the founder of Theosophy. I guess the broader point there is, you know, it's interesting. There are all these ideas of Tibet and what Tibetan Buddhism and Tibetan shamanism must be like that are inherited from the early part of the 20th century from Theosophy, but also people like the pulp writer T. Lobsang Rempa, but just Hollywood. And, you know, that has not been helped by kind of like the Indiana Jones type take on things from Hollywood. But much like with every other esoteric practice in the world, in the last 30, 40, 50 years, now we have, because of people fleeing Tibet, we have actual teachers here. We have actual academic writing. We have actual understanding of the techniques from, like, you know, like actual anthropologists. And it is, of course, way less glamorous than this kind of like pulp fiction imagined version of it. And so I imagine that Bone can only benefit from that, being that it had so this negative. But let me ask you this. Is there anything in Bone that possibly could be, that could have a negative attribution given to it? I mean, there's got to be some sorcery or God knows what black magic.
No.
I can tell you this, that I don't speak Tibetan, but I have had teachings from a wide variety of the people who are qualified teachers. In other words, they've had Geshe degrees and have studied and been awarded and been able to come. One of the things when you come to a teaching is that they start out with their introduction of who they are, who their teachers were, what their lineage was, how they got the transmission of the teaching, and how they are authorized to be able to teach the text. And so there's a, like you said, authentic teachings that are going on now and so forth. I can tell you, in over 20 years of studying, I have not heard of anything that is black sorcery. Bummer. That doesn't.
That's the stuff that, that's the only, that's all the stuff that everyone like says they don't have, but that's the stuff that I want.
Well, I can tell you this, and I can tell you this is that they do tell stories about people who are highly realized, who can recognize that that everything is space, that there is no concrete, there's nothing concrete about anything. We're all interdependent and there's space everywhere. And they understand that these practitioners who have studied for so long and maybe been at it for a number of lifetimes can walk through walls, or they can fly, or they can. Most often it's easiest to time travel or space travel, mostly space travel, in their sleep. They go to visit, when they go to sleep, they're able to do lucid travel to other places and carry on conversations. So if that's sorcery, I don't consider that sorcery, but I do consider it a bit of what we might think of as magic.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
Those are stories those are stories that we do hear about, but black sorcery, not a word. Now, there are plenty of stuff that they don't talk to us about. I can guarantee you that, but there's
this is hilarious. I was like, is there sorcery? And you said, oh, there's no sorcery. No, they just space travel in their minds while they're sleeping. It's like, okay, so let's talk about magic.
I said, there's no black sorcery. There's no black sorcery that I know of. So, okay. Negative, or let me see, evil, negative, harmful. That's what I mean by that.
Well, it sounds like there's some colorful stories about other types of magic, some of the stuff you were talking about. So
there's a number of times in the book where they are traveling along and magic, what I would call magic, you could call it the protectors that came to help them. You can, you can decide for yourself what the force is that allowed these things to happen. But that's one of the things that we found out in writing this book. We'd get to a story and they would tell us something and we'd go again and again and again. The events opened up for them. Tenzin Namdok, our major character, was shot and in a concentration camp for a while. And then when they left the concentration camp to leave, they were going to have to cross a river that was wide and deep and rough. And they didn't know how, and they'd have to do it at night with nobody knowing where they were or how to do it. And they didn't know how they were going to do it. So that was a big worry for them. And they were walking along and they crossed a frozen lake. And they kept walking and they turned back and they looked at the stars, the reflection of the stars on this frozen lake water across there. And it was so glorious. And then they started rising up out of that area and they realized that they had just walked across the river. That for whatever reason, magic, the protectors, the divine came to be. But that section of the river where they needed to cross was frozen at the time that they needed to cross. And that's just one instance of time after time after time that this occurred. He was shut and laying in the dirt, dying and bleeding. And the Chinese were walking through the camp, finishing people off that they hadn't already shot. And one of them stood over him with his gun cocked. And another one said, "Oh, don't shoot him. Don't shoot." So he walked away and left him alive. How did that happen? Was that magic? Was it, you know, so there were so many incidences in this book where that magic occurred. It's just awe-inspiring.
That's incredible. And it sounds like, well, I just feel like we could do the rest of the podcast telling magic stories. I mean, that would be amazing.
Sure.
It would be incredible. But there's a lot, there's a lot I want to talk about China too, but I feel like before we kind of get into that, what is the basic practice of Bon? Like what is a Bon practitioner do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, there is a book. In fact, it was the first book written in Tibetan in English for the West. And was done back in the 60s by Tenzin Namdok and David Snellgrove, called The Nine Ways of Bon. And what it does is it lays out the different levels of practices that could be done. So those practices are tools and also ways of connecting with the religion. So there are practices that are to help you to live healthy and long so that you are able to practice. And then there are sutric practices where you can learn to walk a path that avoids problems. There are tantric practices where you essentially what you do is that you imagine, you practice transforming into one of the enlightened deities. And so that you get to practice being perfect for a little while. And it's used as a way of developing the kind of essence that particular deity is maybe helpful, because it's all inside you. It's all inside you to begin with. That's your natural state. So by using a tantric practice, then you get to develop those skills and the essence of that within you as you do that practice. Whether it's to be more peaceful or to be more powerful or to be healing or whatever, whatever is necessary for you. And so those are tantric practices. And then the Dzogchen practices are mind training or concentration. It's what you were talking about in terms of the higher, and I don't know about higher because it's different from, but it's a practice where you train your mind in order to realize your natural state.
It's really interesting hearing you describe this. It's incredible how similar magical practices are all over the world. Because everything you've just been describing could be about the Golden Dawn, you know, or what type of Western magic I teach. You know, like we call it assumption of God forms, where you let a deity.
Oh, the tantric?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then, you know, Dzogchen. This is, we just have different names for all of that stuff. But you know, whether that's because those techniques have just spread all over the world, the ancient world, or whether it's because human beings all have, you know, comparably basically the same neurology and so the same experiences available to them, I don't know. But I'm just remarking on it as you talk about it. It's very interesting. What it means, I don't know, but it's interesting.
It is interesting. I often watch a ceremony or a ritual from another tradition, and I look at it and see very similar components to it as I do at the rituals of Bon. And I always wonder about that. There's been a number of people that have studied and done some thinking about the Native Americans and the Bonpos having similar traditions and even maybe genetics, with maybe coming across the land bridge, you know, the Mongolian coming across the land bridge. So yeah, that's really interesting.
I think that's the Hopi and the Tibetans are consider themselves related, which is bizarre, but it's super fascinating.
Yes.
It's super interesting.
Well, they're both the Native Americans, like the Hopis, for example, are very earth-based and intertwined with the elements, and Bones also. That's one of the differences in Bon and Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, is that Bon has many more of their practices grounded in the elements, the connection to the elements.
So that makes it also sound much closer to Western magic, even than Vajrayana, which is Western magic is completely rooted in elements.
Right. We have they recognize five elements: earth, water, air, fire, and space.
So basically same as Western, although the Western magic took it from Eastern Tantra, but still fascinating. So at this point, like in 2024, for a Westerner who's, you know, let's face it, getting on the internet and stepping out into the supermarket of religions and beliefs and ideologies and people to be and social media and all of this, why would a Westerner now decide to practice Bon? And two, why would they decide to practice it instead of, if a Westerner was going to go down the Tibetan trip, like they're going to go to probably Galug Vajrayana or Karmakaju, the things that are broadly available, or maybe the others, but you know, why would somebody go for Bon instead of just Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, I don't know. The Buddha at one point, and I'm not sure if it was Tompa Shenrab or Shakyamuni, said there's 64,000 different teachings because there are that many different people who have different needs and understandings and preferences and little tiny things. It's a connection that you get for some reason. Maybe it's karmic. I don't, you know, from previous lives, or just happenstance. When it happens, I don't know. So I don't know how one person gets connected to another something. Sometimes it has to do with the teacher that they run into and some sort of a heart connection. Sometimes it has to do, for me, I was attracted to it because of the elements, the connection to the elements in the earth. And so, and how much it's intertwined in all of that. So I don't know how to answer that, because I'm not sure that I know why everybody is hunting. If they're going down the path of looking for religion, they're going there for some reason that is integral to themselves and is personal. And so Bon is not a proselytizing religion. It's just, if we're here, this is what it is. If you're attracted to it, if you're curious, here we are. But it's definitely not a proselytizing religion. So I'd have to say it would only come because someone was curious or something about it attracted them.
Yeah, I have to say that in the last 40 years, Bon has, at which probably in the 60s, the Bon Pos were probably only in northern India, Tibet, Bhutan, and Nepal, but in the last 40 years, they've spread. You can find Bon Po communities almost in every European country, in Russia, in Brazil, in Mexico has a very large Bon community, in Canada, and across the United States. Now, the numbers are not large, but it's attracting people for whatever reason. I can't tell you why, but it does.
Very cool. Yeah, it seems to me that the future of the Tibetan traditions is very much in North America, but that's just me. But let's talk about why. So I definitely want to talk a lot about the political situation in China, particularly because it very rarely comes back into the news, but is continually occurring and is very easily overshadowed by other things going on in the world. Let's just start this off. Talk about, please, the title of your book, The Flight of the Bon Monks. Talk about that specific story and them fleeing Chinese oppression and what happened there, please.
So the the Chinese invaded in 1950, and the Chinese didn't know Buddhism from Bun or anything. But initially, on instruction from Mao, they were to try to befriend the Tibetans, and which they did. So Chinese soldiers would go in and help harvest crops, and they would pay for everything they got, and they tried to be friendly. But by 1956, there was an open rebellion in the eastern provinces of Kham and Amdo. And because the Chinese went in, the first thing they did in Kham was they took away the weapons from the Kampas. Well, Kampas traditionally are always going around armed, usually with a rifle and a sword. Had always been warring between tribes and things. That's just part of their tradition. And so they were incensed by having their arms taken away. And eventually that led to this rebellion about 1956. And they began. And so there was the Chinese over time became gradually more oppressive and more disrespectful of Tibetan traditions, even though they had promised to respect their religion and their culture. But in practice, they weren't doing that. And they were Chinese regarded religion as an enemy of the state. It was an enemy ideology. And they said that monks and were enemies of the state and should be eradicated. And so by 1959, the Chinese were so hated in Lhasa that it resulted in this vicious, violent rebellion in which about probably 15,000 Tibetans were killed. And that is when the Dalai Lama fled. And so with that rebellion, the Chinese really, you know, all bets were off. Any pretense of respecting cultural religion was off, and they went after monks, and they were tortured them. They did things like throw monks in a pit and urinate on them, and then say, hey, why don't you get your god to just let you fly out of the pit? And in one case, they took a monk and they had this, the monks were celibate, right? And so they would force them to have sex, or they would have this woman get on this monk. They had him get down on all fours like a horse. The woman rode him like a horse, and they forced him to eat grass, you know, terrible things like that. And so Bun was the smaller of the two religions. So it was affected correspondingly. The impacts were more up on Bun because they had fewer monasteries and fewer adherents. So the main monastery for Bun was Menri Monastery in Tibet, which was about 100, 150 miles west of Lhasa. And it was up in a mountainside and not easy to get to. But the Chinese came there and they started watching that monastery. They had Chinese officials there would take the monks and to these sessions in which they would try to convince them that their religion was, they should get rid of their religion. And finally they said, look, you're going to take the black road or the white road. And so the head of the Bon religion was the abbot of Menri Monastery. And he knew that if they take the white road, they go along with the Chinese communist and just do their bidding and give up their traditions. The black road meant that they would come in there and torture, kill them, imprison them. And so some of the monks renounce their vows so that they could take up arms. They renounce their vows of nonviolence so they could protect the abbot And he fled with this small group of monks who had renounced their vows. There were about 500 monks in Minri Monastery at that time. And so there was something like 20, 25 of them renounced their vows to protect the abbot. And we were able to interview one of those monks, Tempo Woser. And anyways, they escaped and they made their way toward Tenzin Namdok. Tenzin Namdok is the main character in our story. He had been the head teacher at Minri, and he had gone to this remote monastery on the Changpeng Plateau, which is higher than the rest of Tibet. It's one of the most desolate areas on the planet. But there are a community of nomads there that raise and a few farmers. And traditionally, it had been a place where they would get money and income from that area for the main monastery. And he had gone there to try to revitalize that monastery there and get more income for the main monastery, which was in need of funds. So that he was there at the time when the abbot escaped. And the first thing they did is make their way toward Tenzin Namdok, who was probably the most respected monk in the Bun tradition and still is today. And he is still alive today.
So we really had two groups. We had Samten Karmi and Sanjay Tenzin, who later became the abbot and was known as His Holiness, were in Lhasa, and they at Daeprung Monastery, and they witnessed the rebellion in Lhasa. And then as a result of that, they fled. It was about 3 or 4 days after the Dalai Lama did. And so they fled and went down through to Nepal. So that was one story of flight. And then the other story of flight was the flight from the Minri Monastery monks up to Sezik, and then from Sezik on out to Nepal. And that's during that second flight from Sezik is when our main character was shot. And all of the story surrounding that and his being captured and put into a concentration camp for 10 months before he was able to flee again, have another flight over the Himalayas and into Nepal.
So the ones that were able to escape, I'm curious, what happened to the ones who were able to escape, and also what happened to the ones who were not able to escape?
The ones who escaped, sort of through various ways and means, made a life for themselves in exile. And what happened was our three main characters ended up getting together with David Snellgrove and going to London and spending 3 years in London, which changed their lives. Samten Karmi stayed as an academician and became the top Tibetan academician in the world right now. And then of the other two came back and established a Bun community in northern India and then reestablished a monastery there. So it, by hook or crook, the ones that didn't get out were either killed or imprisoned or sent to do other jobs like cleaning pigs.
So, okay. And so you've mentioned concentration camps multiple times. It sounds like those were in operation when the Chinese came in and are still in operation. What's the story with those?
At the time, what it's interesting because the concentration camp was a collection of people that were overseen by either Chinese or Tibetans that had turned over to become guardians of the Tibetans for the Chinese. So we had Tibetans that gave up and became Chinese aides, but everybody had their animals. And so a concentration camp was really just a collection of tents. It was almost like a gathering, but it was a collection of tents and the animals, and it had to move as the animals were grazed, but it was guarded. And so that was what we call a concentration camp, was that. And if there was, and then as they became more organized as the rebellion went further. I mean, as the takeover went further along, then the concentration camps became more established as actual buildings and wire and all of that kind of stuff. So at this point, where he was a guarded open space that was where everybody was required to be there to move from one space to another. You had to have a pass. You had to be guarded. Everybody was guarded and you could be reported if you weren't where you're supposed to be.
We're not talking about death camps. We're talking about holding areas.
Holding pens, yes. Now, like I said, later, as they got more established and more concentrated, then there became death camps, but not a concentration camp like that.
Not death camps, though.
Not like the Holocaust. No, they were more like prisons.
But people were being tortured and killed in them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
How does that relate to, you know, we hear about the concentration camps for the Uyghur Muslims now in China, and I presume there are still concentration camps for Tibetans. I don't know. You happen to know where things are at with that?
I don't know of any concentration camps for Tibetans right now. I know that there are Tibetans that are in prison, but I don't know of any sort of what's called concentration camps. And I'm not familiar with the Uyghur concentration camps, if they are just areas that are guarded like that, or if they're actual walled off concentration, you know, fenced up areas. But it is a situation where you have a totalitarian state that has decided that they don't like particular groups of people within their what they have claimed is theirs.
But they don't need concentrations now because the Chinese presence in Tibet is so huge that Tibetans are now a minority in their own country. And there's, for instance, when we went to Tibet, we were in Lhasa. In downtown Lhasa, there were police kiosks like every 100 meters. And throughout the city, there were military outposts. You could see presence was everywhere. And we went to a Buddhist monastery, a small Buddhist monastery. And on the wall, they had a plaque that showed an organizational chart. And the abbot was on there, and then the monks below that. But above the abbot was a Chinese communist official. So they have subjugated the monasteries to the Chinese Communist Party. We went to the old Minri Monastery, and they were building, at that time, that was 2014, I believe, they were building a police station right below Minri Monastery. And so this is Minri Monastery is in a remote location. The nearest village is maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 miles away. And yet they're building a police station right below the monastery. And they had built roads because there was no road up to Minri Monastery until the Chinese government built a road up there. And it was clear they built that so they could get to the monastery easily and exert their control. When we went to the monastery, we were told that they're not to say anything, not to ask any, not try to ask questions or interview any of the monks there because there were spies for the Chinese government among the monks, and that any information, any conversation we had would be reported to authorities, and the authorities would talk to or interview each person that we talked to and ask them what we said to them. And so it was a very oppressive atmosphere there.
What is the attitude of the Chinese to the Tibetans currently? And I'm curious, what do you think the actual reason that they don't like them is? Is it actually about religion? Is it just that they're on their land, or they think that they want, or rather they want their land? Is it just that that's the Tibetans' land, but they want the land? Is it natural resources? Is it old tribal ethnic conflicts going back to Genghis Khan? I mean, but I guess I'm asking in a very tangible, lived, and since you've been there, kind of real experience, what is the attitude of the Chinese to the Tibetans, and why do they like them so much?
We haven't been there in 10 years. So, but I think it's been, I think it's actually become more oppressive. And in part because of the emulations, those started after we had been there, or not actually after, but they were ongoing as when we were there. And so the emulations were a great embarrassment to them because it was so...
Made things worse?
Horrific, yes. So there was more crackdown. So there was more crackdown over it.
Something and, like 200, 300 monks burned themselves alive. Because I remember when that was happening, they were practically burning themselves alive every day or every week, something like that. It just started to get media attention. So that made it worse.
Yes. Most of them were up in the northeast part of Tibet, but one person did emulate themselves in the Barkhor there in Lhasa. And then, man, they shut down the Barkhor. They took all of the vendors out of the Barkhor and moved them over into a separate building where no tourists go. So they didn't have really much of any income. You had to go through a metal detector to get into the Barkhor. They checked for matches and lighters and would take away a match or a lighter if you had anything like that. So, and then the Guardian reported on a story just recently where a Tibetan here and a part of the diaspora here in the States got a phone call from their relatives in Tibet. And the relatives, there was a Chinese official sitting there and said, you need to be careful what you say in your country because we still have control of your relatives here in Tibet.
Wow.
Yeah. And we had a lot of the Bun community was very supportive of us writing this book, but there is not a single Bun that has put their name on this book because they are afraid for their relatives in Tibet.
Did you start to feel nervous about reprisal from the Chinese government or getting into territory that you felt maybe you didn't know where you were or were a bit over your head? Did that...
We were writing or when we were there?
Either. Either, I guess, just becoming involved in this whole world.
We're not afraid for ourselves. We are not afraid for ourselves. We were, when we were in Tibet, we were concerned that we'd get kicked out. That would be probably the worst that would happen to us, is that we would get kicked out. But we were very concerned that anyone associated with the book or with the stories or that were part of our team when we were in Tibet would be harmed by anything. So we were extremely careful when we were in Tibet to essentially be on a pilgrimage only. And with the book, we tried to check with everyone to make sure we didn't have anything in there that was going to cause any harm short or long term to anybody. That we don't, above all else, could do no harm. So, and yet it was an important piece of history. We wanted to get the history told.
Well, also, I have to say that when we went there, we did not tell anyone that we were doing research for a book. And number two, I was a working journalist at the time, and I lied and said that I was a veterinary assistant because my wife was a veterinarian at the time, which was partially true, but...
Yeah, I'd haul him in there on weekends to go to work with me.
I never told anyone, when we were there that I was a journalist. And because had I told them that, then I'm sure that I would have been ejected. And if they'd known we were researching our book, they would have ejected us as well. And when we got to the airport, let me back up a little bit. To get into Tibet, you have to contract with a government-approved guide, and so, which we did. And so when we got there, they would not let us officially into the country through this turnstile until our guide arrived. And then when our guide was late, so we had to wait around for a while, and then when they arrived, they let us through. But even then, we had to be careful what we said to them because they were reporting back to the Chinese about our circumstances. And so we're very careful there. When we're in our hotel, they eavesdrop on people. So we, even when we're in our hotel room, we were careful not to say anything that would be incriminating.
I'm curious, as a journalist, just kind of putting that journalist hat on, and as I'm sure with your skills of interviewing people, asking open-ended questions, like seeing, reading between the lines, and just getting an intuitive sense of people from a suspicious journalistic viewpoint, what was your take on the Chinese, like basically the Chinese officials you interacted with there and the Chinese regime in Tibet? What was your basic feeling about it?
I mean, we didn't interview we didn't have any interaction with Chinese officials other than like at roadblocks or, you know, coming into the airport or, you know, if we were stopped or something like that. That's the only interactions we had with Chinese officials. And we frankly did not want to have any interactions with them because it, you know, if we said something that it could incriminate ourselves, we could be in trouble. So we were very careful about that.
Although I do have to say, Harvey had a medical issue that when we were there and we had to take advantage of the Chinese medical with a hospital, military hospital in Lhasa, and they treated him quite well. And it was, we didn't have any problems at all. And they took good care of him.
Interestingly enough, they put us in this big hospital room. I actually had two rooms, one room for visitors, and then this big hospital room with a TV and its own bathroom and everything. And so, and they had specialists come in and do all these kind of things. And after that stay at the hospital, we got the bill. It was like $200. I mean, it would have been $20,000 it had been in the United States. So
did you feel that you, as time went on, or did you feel at all that you could begin to get a sense of the core of the Chinese hostility towards the Tibetans?
They're a totalitarian regime. It is evident. Everything is intimidating because there is so much presence. And I don't know whether that intimidation and presence is as, I mean, I'm sure it's much more for the Tibetans, but I wonder if the Chinese living there don't feel it as well. I know that there are people who complain about the government here in the United States, but unless you have lived or visited or been under a totalitarian regime, you cannot imagine what it is like. It was so intimidating. The trip to Tibet was extremely difficult. It was difficult physically because of the altitude, and it was difficult psychologically because of the intimidation. It was really hard. It was really bittersweet. And so it was very difficult. If anyone has a chance to go, I recommend it because it is an amazing country. It is the very definition of the word vast. And the air is so thin because of the altitude, the air is so thin that you can see forever and it is crystal clear. But at the same time, it is the Chinese presence is very, very intimidating. And that intimidation just sort of seeps into you while you're there.
Talk about some of the differences there. I mean, like the different, you mentioned the differences between America and totalitarian countries. And this is something that people very much need to hear more of these days. I think with the difference between America and actual totalitarianism, I'm curious, what are some of the differences, some of the gaps there, and maybe like little things you wouldn't notice or think of, like maybe running water or something. I don't know, something like that.
You know that in your hotel room, they're listening to you. And I don't think I'm listened to in every hotel room I stay in here in the States, but they listen to your room. So you've got your rooms bugged and you have to have a person with you. If you're a foreigner, you have to have a guide with you at all times. So you can't just go out and wander around and check out the shops and stuff like that. A guide has to be with you at all times. So you're escorted everywhere you go. We would drive down the highway when we went from Lhasa up onto the Chong Tong. You drive along and every, I don't know, 5 miles, 10 miles, there's a check stop. And you check and the driver gets a piece of paper that's stamped with the time on it. And when you get to the next check stop, if you get there too fast, you get a ticket for speeding. And if you get there too slow, they're going to interrogate you about where you've been.
That sounds like sundown. It sounds like sundown towns under segregation in the South.
And there's a railroad from Beijing to Lhasa. And probably every half mile or mile, there's a little along the railroad, and especially anywhere where there's had to be a little bridge to get underneath it or past it, there's a tent. And in that tent is a Chinese soldier. Those poor guys had to live there on the side by the railroad. And they were there, you know, I figure someone who wanted to blow up that railroad crossing could figure out a way to do it. But the idea is that there's someone there watching, and all the time, a Chinese soldier is there all the time, every mile along the route of this road, of this railroad. So it's just this overwhelming presence that is there, and you know you're being watched all the time.
What does that feel like, being... knowing you're being watched? I mean, like, people literally look like watching you. What does that feel like over time?
It's creepy. It's really creepy. And it's intimidating. And it makes you start to, you know, to close in. And to, it makes it hard for you to feel free. It actually even makes you hard to feel happy.
As a visitor, as a Western tourist, what can you not say or do? And what happens if you say that or do that?
I don't know. I'm a military brat. I've grown up traveling all over the world, and I try to be respectful of the countries that we go to, because and they learn from the new cult, the other cultures. So I didn't do anything or say anything that I know of. You know, different cultures needs different things. So you have to be aware of the customs of those cultures if you don't want to violate any of them. I try to be respectful, and Harvey, of course, as well, we're trying to be as respectful as we can. I think for us, the worst that could happen is that we would get kicked out of the country, called in, and then asked to be told to we have to leave. The problem that we had was we didn't want to get anybody else in trouble. So our guides could lose their business if we started doing whatever the government didn't want us to do. Then our guides could lose their business, because they're responsible for our actions. And so we didn't want to have our guides, anything happen to our guides. They're just trying to make a living.
Yeah.
I mean, the main thing is you can't say anything nice about the Dalai Lama or talk smack about the Chinese government. That's basically
not even
basically
a little
it. I think that the Chinese, to answer your earlier question, their main interest is in keeping Tibet because it's rich in minerals.
Okay.
And they want those minerals in there and
water
and
minerals and water.
And secondly, they see that they've been unable to get wean Tibetans away from Buddhism. The Tibetans steadfastly are holding on to Buddhism, and the Chinese see religion as an enemy of the state.
Are they still basically, I don't understand the Chinese political system at all, man. It's like, are they basically still Maoists? Are they still communists? They just see religion as poison?
They're still communists.
Hybrid economy, like they've adopted capitalist stuff as well.
Right. But it's, they rationalize that as it's capitalism in a communist context.
What I see happened is that we opened up the doors of capitalism to them in order to try, because we thought that capitalism would begin to open the system up away from communism. And what I see happened, and whether this is the case or not, but in my personal opinion, what I see is that they adopted capitalism so they would have more money to practice their totalitarian regime.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I mean, that has put the lie to that idea that somehow
thank you for explaining it that way. That's really dark when you put it that way. That makes it perfectly clear. Sorry, go ahead.
That's what I see, because it hasn't touched their totalitarianism. It's just given them more money in order to practice it.
Yeah, and I was just saying that just puts the lie to this idea that capitalism will bring democracy. It has not done that at all. And the current leader of China, if anything, is more oppressive than the previous leader.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the wealth trickles down, if you
no.
insist.
For the Chinese, I think their standard of living has been raised.
Yeah, they have the biggest middle class.
You look at the Tibetans, are not doing as well as the Chinese who have settled in Tibet and now outnumber them.
Yeah. We hear a lot about China being, I mean, obviously this has similarities to other conflicts in the world, but we hear a lot about China being brought up as a potential enemy, as a, you know, essentially the new Soviet Union, the nemesis for the United States. Do you see China as a credible threat? Do you feel that this is U.S. propaganda, or do you feel that there actually could be a conflict brewing potentially? Or I don't know how, or just, I don't know if you feel that they, from being there, whether they would actually pose a threat to the U.S. or not.
No, I think it's a distinct possibility. I think one thing that by opening up China and of us making investments there is that there are a lot of economic links to China now with the outside world, from the United States and Europe. And the Chinese are dependent on a lot of that for income and for materials and different things. And they need U.S. as a market, and they need Europe as a market. And so the thing is, the dangerous thing is that ideology can often outweigh economics or rationality. And the current Chinese leader is more prone. He's on a road that emphasizes ideology over practicality.
I didn't realize that. I figured that the Chinese to be much currently the Chinese government to be much more kind of pragmatic, but
no, in fact,
ideological.
Well, in fact, what they've done is Western businesses there, they've actually raided some of the Western businesses there and accused them of espionage and what U.S. businesses were doing is what they do in the United States or any other country. They collect data so they can own their markets, right? So you want to know how many people this age are buying our product, and they're doing that. And the Chinese want to be in control of that data. And so they look at that and they say, oh, so you're getting that data. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. They're doing that right back to us with TikTok and Temu and all of this, Alibaba.
Well, that's true. But nevertheless, they want to be in control of the data. And so anyway, and the Chinese economy now is shrinking. And the reason is because they have cracked down on all these Western enterprises, and their current economic policy is really not the optimum.
Yeah.
And it's they're more concerned about Taiwan and imposing communist ideology and those kinds of things at the moment. Now whether that could change, but that's the current movement.
Jackie, you were gonna jump in with something?
I was just gonna say I think it's very scary.
It seems like you're both
very scary. And I think it's very complicated, and there's a lot of factors that you have to factor into it, and things that can change from one year to another year in terms of the economy and the philosophy and the ideology and so on and so forth. But they're very powerful and they're very scary, completely totalitarian. And so I think it behooves us to stay informed and to stay connected so that we know and can understand what's going on in the area, which is complicated, but nonetheless, it's sort of like something that we should do. And hopefully the people that are decision makers are doing that. I think they probably are.
Yeah. It's interesting. You said stay informed, but I heard it as stay in form, as in stay on point, stay aware. What do you think if, let's say, the U.S. and China were to go in a conflict? I don't know what that would look, maybe a trade war, but being that there's a gigantic ocean between us, I don't know what that would look like. But let's say that we do go into conflict, say, around Taiwan or something like that, but it is an openly acknowledged conflict. What would that mean for the Tibetans in China and potentially here as well?
I have no idea. I have no idea. You know, a lot of it will depend on what, if they take any positions or not. I suspect it just mean that they continue to, that life is normal, but who knows? And I don't know. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, I don't see that having a big effect on them, because the Tibetan society now is under so much oppression that I don't, it's certainly, if anything, if a war between the United States and China broke out, it would become more oppressive probably. And they'd be trying to root out traitors, and even more so than they are now.
I would worry about people being declared fifth column or something like that.
Yes.
Do you know about the, just as an aside, do you know about the CIA program to train the Tibetans in America in the 1950s?
We did study that and wrote about it in the book.
Okay. Yeah, we have a whole chapter on that.
Okay. I am fascinated by this. Please tell the story.
A reference that I would recommend to you is John Kenneth Nowse's book on that. There's two or three books out, but his is one of the better ones that he writes, that is written out there. And it was secret for a long time. And so it wasn't known that it was happening. But during this was after World War II, and when the communists took over China, and the United States was looking for a way to keep track of China and what was going on and sort of harass them a little bit here and there. And so they used the Tibetans to do that. And it was, so they recruited Tibetan men, mostly young Kompas that had already escaped, had been fighting up in the east, and then came down and came and escaped from Tibet, were unable to stay without being captured or killed. And so, and they took them and started to train them in different weapons and using radios and so forth, and then would drop them back into Tibet for them to hook up with the resistance, the Tibetan resistance, and find out what was going on, where the Chinese troops were, what was going on and so forth. They eventually moved the training grounds to Camp Hale in Colorado, and so that they would be training in territory that was more familiar with them up in the mountains and in a little bit cooler and thinner air. And so they worked there, and this program went on for, I don't know, 6-8 years, Harvey? Is that right? So they dropped a number of, so they kept recruiting people as they needed more people and would train them and then drop them back into Tibet. And then they also would drop arms caches to them. So they would supply them with weapons. When Tenzin Namdok was shot, he was traveling with a warlord who had claimed to be able to get some of the arms, some of the guns that the CIA was supposed to have dropped. We write in the book about whether this was the case or not, whether he was actually on the list, because there's some question about who the lists were. And Tibetans' names are very difficult to follow, and they change their names, and sometimes they're named by where they're from, and sometimes they have family, you know, so it's just hard to know for sure.
Lots of Georges and Tenzins.
Yeah, but there was some question that the Chinese had known about a particular arms drop and had flooded the area with troops, and that this group of lamas that was trying to escape got sort of caught in the middle of all these Chinese troops in this particular area who were hunting down the warriors with the weapons from the CIA. And they just got caught in the middle of that. And that's one of the reasons that they were not able to escape undeterred.
Is the fact that the Tibetans were being trained at Camp Hale, is that why Naropa is there and why there's such a huge Tibetan community there now?
You know, I don't know. It's interesting. In the United States, there's a Tibetan community in Boulder. There's one up in Minnesota. There are Tibetans in the San Francisco area. There's a good number of Tibetans in the New York area. In Houston, we have a Bunsangha in Houston. And I think in Houston, we have 3 Tibetans total in Houston. So I don't know that they came there because of Camp Hale. I doubt it. I imagine that there were some Tibetans who came to the United States and settled there. And then other Tibetans came there because they were already there. There was a community there. So, but yeah, it's there. And when we visited Camp Hale, when we went by to see it, did our pilgrimage to Camp Hale, there were prayer flags. They had just put up a new historical marker there. And there were prayer flags in the tree next to it and katas tied to the marker. So the Tibetans had been to there to acknowledge the area.
Yeah, at the time, Camp Hale was a secret operation run by the CIA. So, and there were no, their families weren't with them. It was just the operatives who were being trained.
Not sure. Interesting. I was just going to ask something, but then Jackie, you mentioned you have a military background. I'm curious. So my sense of program, and I'm just talking about reading about it on Wikipedia, is that it ended because Henry Kissinger pulled the resources and decided that the proxy war they wanted to have against China was Vietnam, not Tibet. And this seems to me like potentially a bad decision. I wonder if the U.S. would have actually fought China in Tibet. It seems unlikely, but did we just abandon them after that? Like, what happened when that program got ended? Did we continue support in some way, or have we
left them? You know, the U.S. never intended to support Tibet militarily. This was only an intent for the CIA. This was an intelligence gathering operation and a way to just sort of put a pinprick into the Chinese operations. But they did lead the Tibetans to think, because the Tibetans wanted the U.S. to come in on their side and drive the Chinese out, or at least give them the military capability so they could do it. And the U.S. never intended to do that, but they let the Tibetans believe that. And the Tibetans were very bitter about that, when they finally realized that we never intended to do what we led them to believe.
Yeah, we've just been screwing over our allies all over the world. Same with Afghanistan. I didn't know that part. That's a shame. So what about now? I mean, is it just not a priority? We don't care?
Yeah, we...
What? To Tibetans?
The U.S. government, we just don't care about the Tibetans.
It's tricky, because they want to maintain a communication with China. And China, you can't talk about Tibet with China. Now, the United States has passed a resolution supporting Tibet and supporting their right to practice their religion and to autonomy within their region. But we're not going to go to war with China over Tibet. And that's what it would take. It's just not going to happen. And so it's a complicated political issue. And the Tibetans are on the losing end of it in terms of overt action as opposed to covert action because of the strength of China.
So is there...
There's no major power that has ever recognized the Tibetan government in exile as a legitimate government. I think there might have been some island or El Salvador or something like that that might have recognized them, but nothing of consequence.
I have to say that we have to give a lot of credit to India and Nepal, who have both stepped up to help support the Tibetan refugees and the diaspora in both of those countries, with much pressure from the Chinese because they're both bordered by China. And so they have stayed firm in their support of the diaspora in their countries. And I have to give them a lot of credit for that.
Very good. So is that the main hope for Tibetans that are still in China or they're still in occupied Tibet? What hope is there for them at this point? Not to put too fine.
Not for Tibetans in Tibet.
I think
they can look forward to Chinese domination into the future. I don't see anything changing that. There's no, I think that some Tibetans have come to just accept, that they're Chinese, and have a few of them. I remember we talked to that one Tibetan. She was from Omdo, and she said, "Oh, the Chinese government, they're great. We love them. They're terrific." And she was visiting someone in New York when we talked to her, but not all. I think that she may be in the minority, and it may be true in Omdo, where she's from, more than other parts of Tibet, because it's so close to the Chinese border, and there's always been a big Chinese influence right there in Omdo.
It's interesting. There's also a big Chinese influence in America now too. I mean, I live in Austin, and I don't know about Houston, but there are. Somebody from China bought the house next to me. They're just buying houses from China and, go out to get barbecue and people are speaking Cantonese, or mainland Chinese. And I moved from Los Angeles, where the PRC was sponsoring street festivals and buying up whole apartment complexes for medical tourism from China, from people who were, women who were coming over here to have babies. And so, yeah, it's like the borders aren't so clear cut anymore, it seems. But I very much hope that we learn the lesson from the Tibetans at the very least about handling China and not letting it get much further, because I definitely don't want to live under totalitarianism, nor does anybody who wants to practice not even just an alternative religion, but a religion, period.
Yes.
Do we pretty much cover everything? I mean, are there bits from that you want to mention that we didn't hit on?
I think the one of the most important part of the story about their flight from Tibet is how meeting David Snowgrove and going to London and learning English there and making connections with the Catholic Church, because the monks all came from monasteries. When they found out there were Christian monasteries, because up until that time, they didn't know any Christians or know anything about Christianity at all. They got permission from the Pope to visit monasteries, and they visited a lot of monasteries, and they made a lot of connections with the Catholic Church. So that when Tenzin returned to India, he was able to get money from Catholic charities to buy land and establish this Bon community in exile, and which was key to keeping the Bon religion together. And so that he founded a Minri monastery in India. And so that is now the center of the Bon religion. It is no longer the Minri in Tibet. And one of our characters, Sangyu Tenzin, he became the abbot of the Minri monastery in India. And he made a journey to Minri monastery in Tibet. And one of the questions there was, would the abbot of that monastery recognize His Holiness Sangye Tenzin as the true abbot? And they went there and he did. And I think the reason for that was because they knew that if the center of the religion remained in Tibet, then they would be subject to Chinese communist influence. and would be that would they would the Chinese would then be able to determine what happened to the Bun religion. And so that is why the center of the Bun religion is no longer in Tibet. It is in India.
Okay. Well, this was an excellent podcast. I should probably jump off. My dog's going crazy. Hopefully you can't hear that.
I wanted to let people know that this book, even though it's a nonfiction, it's a true story, that it, we wrote it so that it would feel like you were there. And it reads like a novel and is an interesting historical. It's not like reading a history book. It's like reading a page turner that'll bring you to Tibet and to London and to India and back to India again. So over the Himalayas. And so if you're interested in Bun, you can read it. If you're interested in Tibet, it's a good read. If you're interested in the Himalayas, it's a good read. And if you're just interested in history, it's an important part of the history.
Or just a good story.
Or just a good story.
And where can people find it and find out more about you?
Flight of the Bun Monks is available in any place you buy books. It's available both in paper and as an ebook. And also we found out that audio version will be available starting next March 5th. And you can find out more about the book, including the prologue. So you can see the style of the writing, and it's at flightofthebunmonks.com. The name of the book.com, Flight of the Bun Monks.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for being on the show. That was an awesome conversation.
All right. Hope you really, really enjoyed that. I definitely had a lot of fun in that conversation. Meet us at magic.me, magick.me, my school for magic, meditation, and mysticism, where you can learn all the skills you need to unleash your true self. I will see you in class. And until next time, hang in there.